It's dark on Observatory Hill. Come on, let's pretend we're Jack and Jill. We'll stroll to the hilltop where college sweethearts go to look at the lights on the campus down below. We'll learn what astronomy is for, and we'll learn what the stars can have in store. I know in advance that the moon may mean romance when it's dark on Observatory Hill.
Oh, and boy. Bob Crosby singing When It's Dark on Observatory Hill, which was a very popular song back in the 1930s, and it had to do with what was going on at the kind of below the Washburn Observatory on Observatory Hill on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll get some backstory on that as we move along today, but we thought it'd be a great way to start as we visit with the co-authors of the new book, Chasing the Stars. And it tells the century-long history of the Washburn Observatory and the work of astronomers on the UW-Madison campus. Great to have Jim Lattice with us, director of the UW Space Place, one of the authors. He's also a faculty associate in astronomy with the UW College of Letters and Sciences. Been with us many a time, but this is the first time to talk about your book. Jim, welcome.
Thank you very much, Larry. It's great to be here.
The other author is Kelly Tyrell. Kelly is a science writer. She is also director of media relations and strategic communications at UW-Madison, and the other author. And Kelly, welcome.
Thank you so much, Larry. We're both excited to be here talking about our book.
Well, it's great to have you here. And as we visit with the two authors, I hope you'll join in. Questions you have about the maybe the UW Observatory, maybe about the universe, maybe about using telescopes, and maybe your grandma or your grandpa, well, maybe you two were involved at the Washburn Observatory at one time in your life, and we'd love to hear your comments about what you might have done while you were there. Easy to join in. You can call us. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, Kelly, one day I sat down on my porch, my front porch, with a copy of your book, and I sat down with a cup of coffee or two, and it was a wonderful day. The sky was bright and shining, and I loved that day. It was so much fun to sit out on the porch and read this fascinating book, Chasing the Stars. You say it's not a scholarly history of Wisconsin astronomy. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so Jim and I have known each other for probably about a decade now. And we met here at the university. I started in 2014 as a science writer, and my job has been to help make the science that happens on our campus accessible for people who aren't already experts in the kinds of really exciting research projects that go on here. And Jim and I had started working together around some of the more public astronomy events that happen in the world, meteors and other things that people get excited about in the nighttime sky. And we had a really good partnership working together, taking the historical knowledge that Jim holds around astronomy and my experience publicly communicating about that science. And we had this idea to write a book that would help bring the history of Washburn Observatory to the present day and really make it vibrant and exciting for people who are maybe already very familiar with Washburn because they visited before, and then maybe others who don't realize the really important connections that our university, that many of us have visited or excited to know, has the important work that it really has brought us into sort of the current moment in astronomy and astrophysics.
Well, it really is a fun and fascinating story. And it just maybe let's go right back to the building of it, Jim Lattice. Built in 1881, if I'm not mistaken. And it was the first privately funded building on the UW-Madison campus. And we had a we had a guy with a lot of money.
That's right, and it's named after him. It's not named after an astronomer. It's named after the guy who had the money. Right, that was Governor Cadwallader Washburn. And Washburn wanted to make a major gift to the university. And he didn't have an astronomical background. In fact, he didn't have much formal education. He was sort of a frontiersman who moved to Wisconsin to seek his fortune in what eventually became heavy industry and lumbering and milling and things like that.
Land acquisition. Yeah,
land agent was how he got started. That's right, yeah. So, which was an exciting life in those days. But Washburn, when he decided to retire from politics and had a large fortune to dispose of, wanted to make a gift to the university. And the that was right at the height of what historians will call the observatory movement in the United States, the American observatory movement. And John Bascom was really important in this, in that he saw the University of Wisconsin. He wanted the University of Wisconsin to move in the direction of what we now call a research university. It was a new pattern in those days for universities, something that was being copied from European models at places like Harvard and MIT and Michigan. And Bascom thought that Wisconsin ought to join that movement. But you need research institutions to be a research university, and those had to be built. So Washburn volunteered to build our first research institution, which was Washburn Observatory. And that was completed in 1881. Yeah, between 1878 and 1881.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And frankly, the observatory, an effigy mound was destroyed when the Washburn Observatory was constructed. But yeah, interesting to me, that first chapter, I really enjoyed that first chapter, which was kind of a history of how effigy mounds built by Wisconsin Indians started way back when. Tell us a little about that.
Sure, Larry. I think it is notable that the observatory is built on a former effigy mound, and the second director, Edward Holden, actually acknowledged this publicly.
Yeah.
And seemed to lament the fact that the observatory was built on such a site. But Jim and I thought it was really important to begin our book with a chapter on the early stargazers of the upper Midwest and in Wisconsin. I think we often focus on what we understand through the lens of Western science, and it was important to us to acknowledge that indigenous peoples were scientists in their own right and remain scientists in their own right. And we really wanted to bring that through line of sort of the original people here up through the present day. And so the book really does begin with the mound builders and the connections between early indigenous people who settled here around 200 before Common Era, and the burial mounds and other features that they built into the landscape to really acknowledge the celestial history that's really important to their origins, and the connections between earth, sky, and water that were very important and remain very important culturally.
It's very interesting to me to read that. We have, you know what, we have Ann in Waldo, Wisconsin, who has something for us, and I think it's pretty cool. So let's get Ann on board here. Ann, thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Thank you. So what have you got for us today?
Well, my father went to school, UW-Madison. He was a history major. He worked for NASA for 32 years. I'm sure he observed in that observatory many times, but I got to take his ashes there and spread them off the balcony.
Oh, well, that's a new one on me. I didn't know that story.
Oh, and what was your father's name?
Ken Fensted.
Ken Fensted. Well,
what did he do for NASA? Was he an engineer or something?
No, he was a public relations officer. Ah. He wrote the releases and gave them to the press, and then he answered questions for the press on all the different missions. We lived in Florida. He worked at NASA Goddard and then NASA headquarters when he retired.
Oh, my goodness me.
Wow.
Well, that seems kind of like an appropriate place then to for his ashes to go. What do you think, Jim?
Well, that's the first I've heard of that one. That's the closest connection of many alums that I can think of. Well, interesting.
That's a great story, Ed. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that. I want to talk telescopes because they're one of the things that Washburn, everybody, they wanted to have a telescope that was at least as good as Harvard's, if I remember right.
Right. Well, so, if somebody volunteers to build you an observatory, then in those days it's how big a telescope can we get? And there were actually some early newspaper reports. There's at least one early newspaper report, which may not have been, I don't know how well informed, but they gave a number that would have made Washburn Observatory the largest telescope in the
United States
at the time. But that was very quickly changed. The story changed right away. So I don't know whether Cadwallader Washburn saw the bill or the quotation or what. But the criterion that he announced, that he's on the record as announcing, is that he wanted the observatory that the university that he was going to build from the university to be on a par with Harvard.
Yeah.
And telescope that always turns into size with telescopes because we talk about the size of the mirror or the lens. And so really that means bigger than Harvard's, which is how it's often kicked around. Ha, bigger than Harvard's. But it was not much bigger than Harvard's. Harvard had a 15-inch telescope, which they still have. And had had from the 1840s when it was one of the biggest in the world. And so the telescope that Washburn ordered from the most famous manufacturer of telescopes in that day, Alvin Clark and Sons, who were up in Massachusetts, when he asked for one that was equal or superior to Harvard's, they sent back a quotation for a 15.5-inch mirror. So that was a half inch bigger than Harvard's. It's a little more complicated than that because building a telescope like that required you to have access to pieces of glass, of optical quality glass of a certain size, and creating those was more of an art than a science in those days. And so the bigger the lens, the harder it was going to be to obtain the glass. And so I don't have the correspondence, unfortunately, but I suspect Clark said, "We've got 15.5. We can do that." And he said, "Okay, that's on a par with Harvard." It was about pretensions. I mean, it was intentions and purposes. Yeah. You know, we wanted to be a research university, and Harvard, even then, was a paragon of that kind of thing. And so that was where Washburn and Bascom. It's a statement about where they wanted this university to go.
Well, Watson. He was the first director of the Washburn Observatory, and he claimed that he had discovered the planet Vulcan, Kelly.
He sure did.
What's the story behind that?
Yeah, so Watson wasn't alone in his time. There were, for a short period anyway, there was this idea that there was a mystery planet between the sun and Mercury. Yeah. And he was certain. He was certain that he was going to find it. He built a special observatory on the hill that no longer exists today. The hill exists. The observatory does not, at least not on Observatory Hill. But he constructed this special place where he was dead set on finding Vulcan. He took special trips during solar eclipses to try and catch the mysterious planet transiting the sun. He claimed to have found it and was very quickly, as scientists are wont to do, nobody else could find it, right? So the other scientists got to work and said, sorry, Dr. Watson, but we cannot confirm your findings. They were probably less polite than that, I'd assume.
Well, there was a pretty good dispute about it that got pretty personal. Yeah, right, so Watson and one other guy thought that they had spotted it during the 1876 solar eclipse. And it was that claim that... Now, Watson was already very well known. He was director of the observatory at University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And held the world's record for discovering asteroids, which was a big deal in those days. And so people took him seriously. And when he said he had found this planet, it was a big deal. And that was... in the that was a great thing just at the time that Washburn was looking for a new director, and so we got Watson, who unfortunately Watson's tenure here was short.
Yeah,
he died just very suddenly before the observatory was even done in the fall of 1880. And so he never really got a chance to test his instrument, but his successor did, Edward Holden, who we mentioned a few minutes ago in a different context there. Edward Holden completed the instrument and tested it and determined that not that Vulcan wasn't there, but that the instrument would not work. And so that pretty much ended the career of that search here.
Well, you know, one thing that really, there were so many things that pleasantly surprised me. I learned so many things just sort of offhand reading the book. And one of them had to do with clocks. Clocks, keeping time, which I had never really thought about before. Keeping time is very important to astronomers. What kind of clocks were used by the Washburn Observatory?
Well, timekeeping actually was a traditional application for astronomers. For observatories, it was very common for observatories to be the source of accurate time. So we've all seen the time ball drop on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Well, observatories had time balls, like at Greenwich in England. There's a ball, and ships' captains could watch through a telescope, watch the time ball drop at noon, and set their chronometers before they set sail. So observatories kept that kind of time. Obviously, we didn't have any such application here in Madison, but by the time the Washburn Observatory was built, there was a demand for telegraphic time signals from the railroads.
This is what really fascinated me.
Right.
They had to know within 2 minutes or something like that?
They needed their timetable, their station masters and their conductors to have clocks, to watches and clocks that were synchronized to within a couple of minutes, because trains can collide, and there had been disastrous train collisions. So the railroads would pay significant money, as much as a few hundred dollars a year, to receive accurate time signals on a daily basis so that they can. And they did that. So the Washburn Observatory transmitted time signals over telegraph lines from the very beginning. Edward Holden set that up. And right on up through the end of the 19th century, the observatories, eventually it all got more or less taken over by the U.S. Naval Observatory. They and Western Union kind of teamed up, and they became and they undercut everybody on price. but for a while there, for about 15, 20 years, the hundreds of dollars, almost over $1,000 a year, was coming into the Washburn Observatory for that service to send out time signals. And that was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
That was enough to employ a student assistant who could then not just deal with the time service mechanisms, which are complicated, but also be helpful to the astronomers in research.
Jim Lattice and Kelly Tyrell are guests today as they talk about their book, Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. Questions, comments, or an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Joe Patnod, our producer today, our technical director is Jeff Robbins. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here talking with Jim Lattice and Kelly Tyrell and their book they co-authored. It's titled Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. You can join in 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, I want to turn to you for a minute, because we haven't, I think we've mentioned men the entire time and haven't mentioned women very much. And they played a role as computers, which was another term that I hadn't heard before, individual people being called computers.
Yeah, it's a funny term to think about people as computers. It's a term that has evolved over you know, the last century, but in the late 19th century, men, predominantly men, were making observations in the night sky through telescopes and needed to record their data and transform it into useful information. We didn't have what we think of as computers today. Most of us walk around with computers in our pockets with our phones. So it really required people who could take that data, do really important calculations that were from the data coming from those observations and turn it into useful information that was then published and shared in all the ways that science today is published and shared. Mm-hmm. Observatories like Washburn, Harvard also had a strong fleet of female computers in the same era. Women were really instrumental in this kind of work. And in the book, we highlight some of those that we know about. This is history, and what survives are you know, what remains in primary materials. But you can learn more about Elizabeth Schofield and Emma Gattaker, Alice Sanborn, several other women in this era who were really important for advancing the astronomical and scientific mission of the university at the time. And I think my favorite story is about Alice Lamb, who was one of the rare women who was allowed to use the telescope and observe overnight, which was not considered a women's job at the time.
Yeah, the men got to work at night. And the women worked in the daytime for the most part, except for Alice Lamb.
Yes, Alice did do some of her own observations alongside working as a computer. And there was a couple of years after Edward Holden went to Lick Observatory, where she and her future husband, Milton Updegraff, actually kept the observatory running and actually produced the only real publishable data in that time period.
Yeah, they were grad students, if I'm not mistaken.
They were basically grad students, that's right. And so they...
Pretty smart grad students.
Well, yeah, and Updegraff made a career as an astronomer, as a naval observatory astronomer. So they were, and Alice Lamb passed up some opportunities to have a career as an astronomer. So yeah, they must have they had the task well in hand there when Holden kind of left them in charge.
Yeah,
and today women thankfully play much more prominent and active roles in astronomy.
Absolutely, and we'll get to that as well. Terry in Lake Geneva has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was listening to you talking about timekeeping. I was a cryptographer in the Navy, and we had to sync all of our equipment every night to Fort Collins, Colorado, down to the microsecond. But what I was interested in was the size of the telescope at Yerkes, since I'm looking at it right now.
Well, the large refractor at Yerkes, they have several telescopes down there. The large refractor, the famous largest refracting telescope in the world that's there, has a lens. We always talk about the size. The lens is 40 inches in diameter. So that dwarfs the Washburn telescope, which even when it was constructed was the third largest in the U.S. after the Dearborn Observatory in Chicago and the U.S. Naval Observatory. But a few years after Washburn was completed in, we'll say, 1881, telescope actually was operational in 1879, Lick Observatory came along in the 1880s with a 36-inch telescope, and then in the 1890s, the Yerkes telescope was built by the University of Chicago, really by Charles Yerkes for the University of Chicago. So that remains the largest refracting telescope in the world, because just about that time, astronomers were recognizing the merits of reflecting telescopes, which are what all of the major research telescopes, including ours, are today.
Yeah. Terry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to George Comstock, for a minute. He was the third director. I think he held that for 30 years.
That's right.
And his research was called the Older Astronomy of Precision, I think was the term used in your book.
Yeah, and that's actually Comstock's term, the Astronomy of Precision, which as his career progressed, he had to start making a distinction between the kind of research that he was doing and the new kinds of research that were growing up really quickly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, more or less what we now call astrophysics. And what that meant was that Comstock was basically making position measurements, usually of stars, by looking through the eyepiece of the telescope, looking through a, there was a special instrument called a filar micrometer.
Yeah.
And they would, this is the astronomer with his, usually his eye at the telescope basically all night, as long as the sky remains clear, making measurements, for example, of double stars. That's my favorite example, I think, because that's how they did it, was look through the eyepiece and measure the spacing and the orientation of two very, very close stars, the vast majority of which turn out to be, and this wasn't clear in those days, but because of that work, we now know that most of them are binary systems. They're actually gravitationally bound systems, and you make these, but they move very slowly. They have orbital periods of sometimes centuries, even more. So these painstaking measurements led to the understanding of star systems, which leads to, and Comstock was doing a certain amount of this, calculating, you can calculate the mass of the stars from, if you can get a good enough understanding of their orbital motions, and understanding the mass of the stars is fundamental to understanding how stars operate. What are stars?
Yeah.
That wasn't even well understood until the 1930s. That was an important scientific question. Where does the energy of stars come from? What's going on with stars? How much do they range in brightness and temperature and things like that? So getting these fundamentals comes out of those painstaking measurements that astronomers were making. Now, that kind of activity was supplanted by photography in the early 20th century, but it was still position measuring.
Yeah,
it was still maximizing the data that you could get out, get as much as you can, squeeze as much as you can out of whether it's the image at the eyepiece or the photographic plate to identify the motions of these things.
And after Comstock, it was a Joel Stebbins, I think, wasn't it?
Right,
it came the director, and he replaced that model with astrophysics.
Right. So that's just, he comes here in 1921 when George Comstock retired. In fact, Stebbins had studied with Comstock, and they were very close.
Good friends.
Friends, yeah. There's no documentation of it, but it certainly looks like Stebbins was actually Comstock's handpicked successor. Right, and Stebbins had been, though, experimenting with one of the very early tools of modern astrophysics before he came here. Basically, the electronic measuring of light, the specific technology was called photoelectric photometry, and he brought that technology here, where he really made it flourish, trained lots of people, and the use of it produced lots of really important research using that telescope up there on the hill, and that kind of photometry is a major part of the early development of astrophysics.
And I think it was around 1932 when Stebbins is quoted as saying, "We shrunk the universe."
Yeah, that's a great story, right? That's actually an eyewitness account by one of the computers reports that Stebbins walked out of the office one day and said, "We shrunk the universe." And that came directly out of that photoelectric photometry, new kinds of measurements that weren't possible without that specific technology that showed that the distances to a number of objects that surround the galaxy, called globular clusters, their distances had been overestimated. And their distribution was then used to infer the size of our galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy.
Okay.
And so the distances were wrong, and he was able to correct them using this photometry, and that produced a factor of three, depending on whose numbers you were working with, a factor of two or three reduction in the overall estimate of the size of our galaxy. Now, he's using the word universe there in kind of an old sense, before the modern concept of galaxy had actually been well defined.
Sure.
The way you would learn it today in astronomy class, they used to call the distribution of stars that we see in the sky the universe. So he had made all of that a fraction of what it had been before they did that work.
And the technology here was different. Other observatories were relying on more photographic means. Mm-hmm. It means we don't have beautiful old pictures here at the university. But instead, the work was really focused on developing these very sensitive detectors. And I think what strikes me and what stood out to me is, as I worked with Jim on this and learned more about the history, is it required Stebbins to reach out to other kinds of scientists, notably a physicist, Jacob Kunz, and really sort of combine what had been sort of an isolated field of astronomy and really start building these partnerships with physicists. And there's some connection here, too, to the very studio that we're sitting in right now, Larry. A lot of the work involved also crossed over into radio. And so there's just a lot of really interesting partnerships that are taking place during this era.
Yeah, I found that really fascinating as well. Well, we need dark skies. And actually, we should go back to that song that we started with just for a minute, because I don't want to forget it before we leave. It's a popular song. It's Dark on Observatory Hill.
Right. That was written by a UW student, or a former UW student, and was a reflected a reality on campus, which was that it's interesting, in 1929, so just as soon as the Depression happens, for some reason UW undergrad men suddenly have lots of cars. I think it must be a direct result of the Depression. I don't really know, but they drove their girlfriends up to the top of the hill, and it became a problem. It became actually sort of notorious. The UW campus was sort of notorious. There's a story about a Chicago Tribune photographer coming up here to get a few pictures of what's going on up on Observatory Hill, and there are references to it in various press. That it's mentioned when Time, I think it was Time, did an article about Joel Stebbins. That's what they led with, was what goes on up on Observatory Hill.
I can actually read. Stebbins didn't like it.
The quote is, "University of Wisconsin Jackson Jills like to go up Madison's Observatory Hill at night."
Yeah. So that that was a part of the culture which actually became a problem for the astronomers.
Yeah, because you got light.
Well, there's the light. The light is a problem. As these electronic detectors became more and more sensitive, you know, your Model A Ford ignition system was not what cars have today. They were pretty sparky and noisy. They gave off a lot of radio, and they could actually detect the cars driving by on their photometers up at the observatory. Now, in those days, Observatory Drive went right next to the observatory, so they were also way closer. So you got all these cars with couples out there in their parking in the dark, and they're right next to the observatory there. So Stebbins actually engaged in a bit of a campaign to get the hill blocked off from traffic, and it's got solved eventually later in the Depression with a CCC program to relocate. There was federal funding to pay to relocate Observatory Hill to its present distance away from the observatory now, and that was part of what was going on there.
Observatory Drive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was interesting to me. You do mention Elizabeth Waters in your book, and she, I think, won the Lewis Prize for
that's right.
a piece that she wrote.
Right along with Frederick Jackson Turner,
And just knowing my own history on Elizabeth Waters, it was interesting to me that you mentioned her in the book, and she left quite a large sum of money to the university following a very distinguished career that had really nothing much to do with astronomy.
Not that I know of.
But Liz Waters Hall, or Elizabeth Waters Hall, is built on Observatory Drive. So I thought that was a nice connection.
Right. It sort of transformed building that dormitory transformed the hill up there. The Lakeshore dorms, I think, were built in the 20s. And those were men's dorms when they were first built. And the women's dorms were over on what is now Park Street. Oh, I guess it was Park Street then, too. The women's dorms were over there. And, Liz Waters was the first big building to be built right up there next to the observatory, but it's part of that expansion of the university westward, and it also disrupted the toboggan run that used to go down Observatory Hill out onto the lake.
There's a lovely photo in the book of that.
I've got to tell you, the photos in your book are fantastic. I love looking at those old photos of the people and that toboggan run. Boy, I would love to have gone down that
yeah,
one.
Yeah. Enough to scare parents there if they think about that. But the pictures, the photos are great, and we really have to thank the people we worked with at UW Archives and the State Historical Society, who are really have great collections and are really helpful with this project.
Yeah, and there. I want to touch, we're getting closer to the end here, but I want to mention Stirling Hall. There were a number of telescopes that were moved or put on Stirling Hall. What's the background on that?
Well, so the astronomy department was outgrowing the observatory pretty rapidly in the 1950s. The university was growing. The post-war growth in higher education was enormous. And Stirling Hall predated the astronomy department's move, but in the mid-50s, they built the east wing of a new wing, the east wing of Stirling Hall, and they built a place for the astronomy department up on the sixth floor. And it was, the intention was, and what happened was, the astronomers moved out of Washburn Observatory, and they moved then one of the telescopes that used to be over at the observatory. They moved up onto the roof of Stirling Hall, and it's still there. It's the famous Burnham telescope, which is discussed in the book. But there are sites up there for fixtures up there for three telescopes.
Yeah.
So a lot of people notice those domes up on top of Stirling Hall, and not only are they still used, but one of the telescopes that used to be at Washburn Observatory is up there, and as it was before, it's still our main student telescope up there.
Well, as the sidelight that I noted in there that really struck with me was that the building, Stirling Hall, had to be restructured, or they had to have additional structures to hold the weight of the telescopes.
Right. It's normal installing telescopes to have a support that's separate from the rest of the building, that is structurally separate, so that the physical support of the telescope is not dependent on the walls, and that's partly for vibration, and partly for stability of the mounting. So there are three piers that run up through the middle of Stirling Hall to support those telescopes.
And I thought your side comment on the fact that the Stirling Hall, during the Stirling Hall bombing, which I'm sure many people are going back to the Vietnam War, that whole building might have come down were it not for those telescopes.
We like to think so. I've never heard a structural engineer say that,
Art Code claimed it.
Art Code said so.
Well, I tell you
Art
what.
I didn't know what he was talking about. Well,
I've already passed that story on in conversation with other friends, and their jaws all drop a little bit at the telling of that story. And there are so many stories that we haven't covered at all. I mean, we've spent a little more time, I think, on the front end of the observatory than the back end, which is really a fascinating part of your book.
I think how the early part of the history set up Wisconsin to be a power, to be an important part of space astronomy is a really important part of the book.
Yeah, even though the observatory is not used today scientifically, it remains an important place for public public visits and not public observation, but the science that it engendered really does have a legacy here today.
Well, you gave me many hours of enjoyment on the porch of my home. Reading this,
I'm so glad to hear that
fascinating book, and you've got, by the way, you're going to be talking. You're going to Mystery to Me tomorrow in Madison.
That's correct. Yep, 6 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah, 6 o'clock. Check their website. Yeah.
Well, and today or tomorrow is tomorrow the official release.
Tomorrow, May 7th.
Although you can get them the books already.
Sure can.
I've heard that people are receiving them. Yes.
Jim Kelly, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
I hope you sell a lot of books. It was a fun read. Thank you. Jim Lattice is director of the UW Space Place. Kelly Tyrell, a co-author, science writer, and director of media relations and strategic communications at UW-Madison. And the book they co-authored is titled Chasing the Stars, How the Astronomers of Observatory Hill Transformed Our Understanding of the Universe. Take a look. I think you'll enjoy it. We're going to stay with the skies a little bit because we've got rocketry in mind. There's a Rockets for Schools competition that will be taking place this coming weekend in Sheboygan. And so we're going to learn more about that and about rocketry in general in our state next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. You know, Wisconsin's got its own rocket man. He is Eric Camberg, and we're going to be talking with him today. I tell you what, we're going to talk about rocket launches as well, because he knows a lot about them. And you ever watch one? The excitement is what I think motivates amateur rocketry clubs to build rockets that can reach heights maybe up to 40,000 feet. It's a competitive sport here in our state and elsewhere as well. And it's also a tool for scientific research. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Eric Camberg, who's been into rocketry since he was 8 years old. 35 years later, he holds the highest national rocketry certifications that you can get. Co-founder of the Model Rocketry Club. It's titled Cool City Rockets, which launches rockets monthly in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. And for 22 years, Eric has helped organize Rockets for Schools, which holds its annual competition this coming weekend, May 11th to the 12th, in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And as we visit with him, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about your experiences with rockets. Did you assist or witness the launch of a rocket? Join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Eric Camberg, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Hey, Larry, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Great to be here.
You got into rocketry as a young guy, still doing it. What keeps you interested in rocketry?
Yeah, so I think you captured kind of the initial essence. A lot of people get into it for the smoke and the fire, kind of the excitement. What keeps people in it, I think, is a variety of things. So me personally, my dad did it as a kid. And so he introduced me to rocketry at a young age. And now I have kids. We have three active generations of Camberg's flying rockets around here. But there's a lot of different parts to it. You had mentioned the competition specifically, or in general in Wisconsin, in eastern Wisconsin this weekend, we have a competition for middle school and high school students from all over the U.S., but primarily the Midwest, where we roll science into it, right? So we have scientific payloads. So a lot of people stay involved with that. I'm a naturally competitive person, so if there's a rocketry contest out there to be competed for, I'm definitely in it, whether it be, you know, the highest or the fastest or whatever it might be. Anytime there's a competition, I tend to participate.
You started at eight. You were probably, I'm guessing, around 19 or so when the movie October Sky came out.
Yes. So, Homer Hickam and Colwood, West Virginia. So I think that was a wonderful book. And then, you know, so the book preceded the movie, but definitely an inspiration. And as I look back and I reflect, and I've read Homer's, many of his books, there's a lot of parallels between his upbringing and mine, except I think he was trying to escape Colwood, West Virginia, in order to get into the rocketry industry. And I've got some pretty deep roots in Wisconsin, so I haven't tried quite as hard to escape. How about that?
Okay. Eugene in Viola has a question for you. Let's go there. Right. Hi, Eugene.
Well, yes, to your guest, I remember building Estes rockets when I was a kid in the 1950s. And there were different sizes and different expenses on those. And I always had to buy the cheaper ones. But they, when you got them set up, they'd go up about so high, and a parachute would open, and then they would come down. And I'm wondering if your guest knows anything about those.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit, Eugene. Yeah, so that's still the essence of model rocketry. So Estes Rockets is still very much around. There's a company called Lock Precision that's right here in Plymouth, Wisconsin, that also manufactures smaller kits for model rocketry. But as you had mentioned, Eugene, there's different sizes of rocket motors, and there's the A through C, which is kind of a standard size, about 3/4 inch diameter by about 3 inches long. And then there's the mighty D12, which dates back to, I think, the early to mid 60s. So, Eugene, they're still cranking those out of Colorado yet. So that's still most people's gateway into model and high power rocketry. Yes, very much so.
So let's talk about model versus high power. You launch both model rockets and larger high powered rockets. Kind of what's the basic differences between those?
Regulations and size. Fantastic question. So model rocketry, still a fairly common thing, I'd say, with schools and 4-H and other learning organizations, and even kids big and old and young and small like myself. So model rocketry, kind of A through D rocket engines, and then high power, that's when you run into bigger rockets, bigger motors, a lot more regulations. So there's, I'm going to try and keep this brief, but there's two national organizations that govern model rocketry. There's Tripoli Rocketry Organization, which focuses more on the high power end of things. And then there's National Association of Rocketry, which is NAR. And they focus more on the model, but definitely include high power as well. So long story short, anytime that rocket gets to be weighing 3.3 pounds or more and containing 125 grams of propellant or more, it's a high power rocket by definition, and it requires certification through one of those two governing bodies. And there's a few other things too. The biggest thing there is that when it enters that high power realm, then we need an FAA waiver in order to fly into airspace. Okay, so there's just a few more rules just to make sure that we keep things safe, which is of course always the number one priority, especially with rocketry.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't want to be flying along someplace and suddenly here comes a rocket right by my plane.
Right, right. Yeah, so just for reference, in the state of Wisconsin, I think there's only two active rocketry waivers. One is in the Fond du Lac area. I think that's 6,000 or 8,000 feet above ground level. And then down near Kenosha, Wisconsin at Bong Recreation Area, there's two groups that fly out of there on a regular basis. They have a waiver to about 10,000 feet. And I think that's ASL above sea level. So
what's what are the largest and highest flying rockets that you yourself have launched?
Yeah. So good question. So there have been people that have flown bigger rockets and higher and faster, but me personally, the largest motor I've ever flown is an O, right? So kind of when we talk about rocket motors, they double each successive letter, right? So a B motor would be twice the power of an A motor and so on and so on. So as you go through the alphabet, by the time you're getting up to an O motor, it's 5 or 6 inches in diameter and 5 or 6 feet long, a lot of power. So I've flown an O motor in that particular flight. There have been a few, but I had one that went pretty fast. It was an O25,000, which doesn't mean too much to anybody, but it went from standing still. It was about a 100-pound rocket, so good-sized rocket. It went from sitting still to Mach 2.3 in 1.48 seconds. it pulled 64 Gs on the way. So you think about if you're ever flying an aircraft, if you're doing aerobatics, the human body, I think, before you start to black out is, 6 to 8 Gs, maybe 10 Gs if you're really conditioned for it. This was 64 Gs, and I had some electronics on board that it actually literally flattened them from the acceleration of the launch.
And you had another one that went or maybe that's the one. How high did that one go?
So that one went about 23,000 feet. So I have gone higher, Larry. So again, there are people that have gone higher than me. My personal best is just under 45,000 feet. And when you talk about FAA waivers, there's only a few places in the U.S. Where you can do that. So one of which is Argonia, Kansas, kind of middle of nowhere. Wheat fields, grain fields, fun stuff like that. And then out west, the Black Rock Desert, Northwest Nevada. So that flight was in the high desert of Northwest Nevada.
Oh man! And now you're the highest national. You have the highest national rocketry certification that available. I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah. So what that means is once you cross over into the high power realm, right? You want to fly those bigger rockets that you can't just get at Hobby Lobby or the local hobby store or even online from EstesRockets.com. So if you want to take that next step, again, the key thing is to join either Tripoli or NAR, right? Those are those two organizations. And then there's a three-step certification process. You can keep yourself at level zero if you want to fly the smaller rockets. You can go to level one, which again is an H or an I motor, fairly small high power rockets. If you want to do level two, you have to take a written test. It's 25 questions on basically safe design and guidance principles of rocketry. And then the other is strictly on safety of rocketry. If you pass that written test, you can fly that larger rocket on a J, K, or an L motor. And if you pass the test and you fly that rocket successfully, then you're level two certified. Level three is, again, the highest you can go. That requires a whole, it's kind of like a design review process where you have to submit a design to this group of people called the technical committee or the NAR, technical advisory panel, I'm sorry. And you submit your design and what you're intending to do and it gets approved. And then that person has to be present for your flight. And if that flight goes well and everything, then you can get certified to level three. You have to fly an M, N, or an O motor.
And Eric has been certified at that three level. Eric Kahenberg, our guest, he's going to be with us right up till 12:30 today as we talk rockets and rocketry here in Wisconsin with him. And you can join in, number 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Back after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking rocketry today on the program as it exists in Wisconsin and elsewhere as well with our guest, Eric Kahenberg, who has been into rocketry for about 35 years. He's co-founder of the Model Rocketry Club. It's called Cool City Rockets. It launches rockets monthly in Two Rivers, Wisconsin area. For 22 years, he's helped organize rockets for schools, which holds its annual competition this coming weekend, the 11th and the 12th, in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So as we talk with more with Eric, I hope you'll join in. Are you a rocketry enthusiast? Have you had some experiences with it? What about experience perhaps in some of the schools that offer this as for kids who are in grade school and high school, as a matter of fact, I believe. Number to call for that is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. How safe is rocketry?
That's a fantastic question. So this is actually my day job, Larry. So I'm all about the safety. So it is one of the safest hobbies, pastime activities that you can actually participate in. So statistically, we've been launching under the current safety code since its inception in about 1957. There have been over 500 million rockets flown safely since then. There was one fatality as recently as 2015. Where unfortunately it was a Boy Scout event out in California. However, the safety code was not being followed at the time. So it's much like other maybe like a gun range where you have safety setbacks, you have a line. You know, we have very much structure to how we conduct a safe launch. All of the rocket motors are electronically ignited, right? So nobody's sitting there lighting the fuse and running. That may have been the way it worked in the 1950s or 60s, but is no longer. So we have safe setbacks. So again, as those rockets and motors get bigger, so do the setback distances. Similarly, you know, we always look at weather conditions. So if the wind is over 20 miles per hour, we simply don't fly. We always have the permission of the landowner to fly, whether it be public land. You know, if it's smaller rockets, it might be in the schoolyard. If it's bigger rockets, it's generally, again, like Vaughan Recreation Area in Wisconsin, or sometimes in the fall, winter, and spring seasons, it's farmers' fields, again, with permission. We only fly when the crops are not above ground. So it is a very safe activity if done properly.
John in New Berlin has a question for you, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was pretty much of a geek, and I was cleaning our library just 2 weeks ago, and I came across a book that I hope your guest is familiar with. It's called Rocket Manual for Amateurs. It was published in 1960 by a Captain Bertrand Brinkley.
Oh.
Wow.
So, Eric, I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking you may not have read this book.
So the Handbook of Model Rocketry, yes, there's a rocket propulsion elements by Sutton. Bertram, I'm not familiar with that one. I am not. Sorry, John.
Oh.
Sounds interesting, though.
So, John, I'm sorry we can't help you out on that one, but I appreciate your call. Let's go to Rob in Appleton. Rob, hello.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. As I told your screener that I'm 71 and I was 16 when Apollo landed on the moon. I'll never forget it. So my brother and I used to blow off SC's rockets, and my father was a pilot, and he got us into model rocketry and into airplanes, not remote, but the ones on the string that we used to cut your finger when you started it. But my question is, the evolution of the technology is amazing to me, to be have those available to you as a citizen of the, I mean, you know, be able to go in a store and buy the advanced stuff that's available. It is just amazing. So what can you tell me about the evolution of the rocketry and the propulsion? Do you use a computer for your high altitude launches? Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Rob. So the evolution over the, say, the last 50 years or so.
Holy cow. That's a big ask, but yeah, we can definitely work on that, Rob. So there's been a ton of the evolution. I would say that the standard Estes stuff that you probably did as a youngster, that hasn't evolved or changed too much. However, new motor technology, a lot of the newer propellants are ammonium perchlorate based, which, if you don't know what that is, it's essentially the same solid rocket propellant that would be in the space shuttle solid rocket boosters and a few years back. And then the new SLS, they also have the solid rocket boosters. So there's kind of more punch in a given size. And then more importantly, you're talking about computers and electronics. I'd say that's where the majority of the evolution has come. A lot of the bigger rockets, they're not relying upon the rocket engine and the rocket motor to provide the ejection where it ejects the parachute. That's all done electronically now. So there's altimeters or accelerometers, sometimes timers, sometimes three-axis gyros that are on board, determining when that rocket gets to apogee, the highest point of the flight, and says, hey, you need to deploy a parachute. And kind of the primitive rocketry, you would deploy that single parachute at that apogee, that highest point, right? Nowadays, as rockets go higher, you typically don't deploy a big parachute, 40,000, 50,000 feet up, whatever, because in that jet stream, it's going to drift miles away and it's gone. So instead, we deploy a little parachute, bring it down really quick, and then at a predetermined altitude above ground, we'll deploy another parachute. So at the top, if you have, say, a 20-pound rocket, you might deploy a 6-inch parachute so it falls really fast, doesn't drift very much. And then 1,000 feet above ground, you deploy a 96-inch, 8-foot chute that's going to lower it to the ground safely. Similarly, there's trackers, whether it be radio frequency, you know, a lot of hams, if there's any hams that are listening in, We use that for tracking as well as GPS tracking. There are even, there's this one, I got to be careful, I'm on the radio. There's this one modern system where it does all kinds of flight events, and it tells you in this woman's voice, her name is Kate. Kate broadcasts the flight over the radio or whatever PA system you have. You know, so it'll tell you launch detected. It'll tell you you're going 650 miles per hour at 2,000 feet, and it'll tell you the steps of the flight as it goes. So if you happen to lose sight of it, or you just geek out on all of the electronical data that's flowing back to you as the flight continues, there's that too. So I'd say a lot of electronics on board, and the tiny bit of maybe not tiny bit, but there's a lot more simulation you can do with rockets now, right? So we had mentioned, not shifting gears too much, but we had mentioned some competitions earlier. Some of the competitions are, hey, we want you to fly the closest to 16,000 feet without going over, right? If you go over, you bust. So there's some simulation that you do ahead of time to say, okay, if I fly this rocket weighing this much on this motor, this combination and these weather conditions, I expect it to go 16,985 feet or whatever it might be, or 15,000. So yes, electronics, kind of the sky's the limit. A lot of times they're riding on board the rockets, especially with the bigger rockets. And then you've got the simulation you can do on the front end.
So I want to go back to the liquid versus the solid for a bit. Maybe talk about, you know, what is a solid rocket booster?
Perfect. So I'll start with the two categories. So Larry, you were asking about liquid. We don't do liquids. So amateur rocketry, it's not covered by either NAR or Tripoli, again, the two organizations. There are some, I'd say, independent groups out in the dry lake beds of California and Nevada that do a bit of liquids. But in general, even us amateurs don't do that. So in solids, you've got two main groups. You've got the black powder, which, again, most people are familiar with if they've ever dabbled in rocketry. That's your Estes rockets. And that black powder is just sulfur, charcoal mixed together, compressed into a cardboard tube, and it's an end burner, burst from the rear end to the forward of the motor. And then there's the other type, the ammonium perchlorate based, much higher energy fuel. Again, same things that they're using in the space program if it's a solid. And that packs a lot more punch per given volume. So plus it gives a much bigger flame, smoke, noise, a better experience all around for the the rocketeer that's enjoying the show.
You've posted videos online of your rocket launches. And so you install cameras on the rockets.
Yeah. So they're one of my favorite personal aspects of the hobby is kind of the hobbies within the hobby that one can take. So I've flown cameras up to 30,000 feet. So you've got kind of not the live stream, but you throw a GoPro on the rocket, and you get your nice aerial views of whatever you're flying. Some people do snapshots. So I think back to, again, referring back to Estes, they have the Estes AstroCam that's existed since probably 1960s or 70s that used to take 110 film and take that single snapshot at Apogee. And it's evolved over time, and now it's digitalized. Having onboard camera video, scientific experiments. Yeah. That's, I think, part of the fun within the fun.
Yeah. Joel Patton, directed me to a video. It's called Rocket Battle 3. And you can't watch that video without just getting excited and kind of pumped up about, rocketry.
Right. So that was an interesting experience. So if people have heard of Dude Perfect, they're a group out of Texas that get excited about all kinds of fun stuff, Larry. And they also have this passion for rocketry. So I was less involved with Model Rocketry Battle 1 and 2, but Battle 3, they said, hey, let's make some big stuff. Let's go and fly it. Let's capture it all on video. There was indeed onboard video with that. And the competition in that case for the dudes that were participating, the highest altitude achieved, that person actually got to ride on the Blue Origin spaceship into space. Okay, so that was a pretty big prize for those gentlemen that were involved. That was a great experience. Those were ridiculously big rockets. I mean, I think the largest one we had was 16 inches in diameter and like 25 feet tall. weighed about 300 pounds. This was just silly big stuff. But yeah, so on YouTube, that video, there's a couple times where there's a guy that looks a little bit like me that's had 42 million views to date. So it's gotten people's attention, I guess.
It is a fantastic video. I forget how long it is. It's not super long, but it's a little longer. But if you type, you know, if you're listening in and you want to see this, and you should take a look, I think if you title in Dude Perfect and YouTube, it's going to pop up.
Right.
It's a crazy. Those guys are, well, they seem crazy, but they're actually pretty darn smart guys.
Right, right. They're pretty sharp, yes.
And one of the things I noted was on the reuse, retrieving. And you do retrieve your rock under any circumstances.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about rocketry is it's not like a firework where it shoots up and goes boom, right? So sometimes there's a misconception that rocketry is single use. So I know several people that have rockets that have flown one single airframe over 100 times. I haven't quite hit that milestone with any of my rockets. I've got a couple that are over 50 flights now. And you had mentioned Cool City Rocketry in Two Rivers. I have one rocket that I fly every single month when we get together. And that one has a little over 40 flights now. So, they launch up, they deploy a parachute. If all goes well, they come back safely to ground. You reload them and do it again.
Let's talk about those rocketry competitions. We've got one for middle school and high school students in Sheboygan, and it's this coming weekend. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's a fantastic program that I actually learned of. Again, dating myself, but back when I was on the tail end of high school. And so it's Rockets for Schools. So you can go to rocketsforschools.org. And it's open to middle and high school students. And it takes place every May in Sheboygan at the Blue Harbor Resort. So students get to build a high-power rocket. There's two different sizes. There's a Class 1, which is essentially that Level 1 size rocket. And there's a Class 2, which is a little bit bigger, about 6 inches in diameter and about 8 feet tall. And they build the rocket. They come up with a scientific experiment that is flown within their respective rocket. They present that on Friday of the event. We have an NASA astronaut that comes and speaks to the students. So it's kind of an indoor day where there's presentations and speeches again from the astronaut. And then on Saturday of the launch, they go outside and with the help of rocketry people like myself, certified rocketry individuals, we fly their high-power rocket and it goes up, launches off the pier, and then recovers in Lake Michigan. So there's always a splashdown. And then we have Coast Guard or Coast Guard auxiliary boats. This year, I believe Dumper Dan is providing the recovery services from Lake Michigan. And they bring them back. The kids open up the payload section and see how their experiment performed, see if it met their hypothesis, whether it's confirmed or not. So really neat program. And again, launches Saturday, indoor activities Friday. It's been going on for, at least 25 years. I want to say it's since 1994, 1996. Just fantastic situation. So not that I have a radio voice, but I am the voice of Mission Control. So on Saturday when the rockets are flying outside, I'll be inside. It's kind of like NASA would have with Houston. We set up a Mission Control area, and there's 10 different stations where students are in charge of marine safety and air safety and pad safety, and just making sure that all the pieces of the puzzle are in place in order to make sure we have safe and successful launches.
So can anybody, I wanted to drive up to Sheboygan on Saturday and watch this. I mean, could anybody join in?
Yes. Open to public, open to spectators. There's a whole bunch of booths and activities inside the Blue Harbor in their convention area where you can go around and for kids, there's actually a stamp program. You can go and you can stamp yourself get stamped at each booth. It's a neat program. There's availability for people to come and watch. There will be barricades that prevent you from getting out onto the pier itself because we maintain that as a safe zone. I would absolutely encourage interested parties of all ages to come out and check it out.
So how many schools, do you know how many schools in the state are involved in rocketry programs?
So I'd say in the past it used to be the majority, but I'll speak specifically to Rockets for Schools first. This year we have 25 teams, which it dipped down quite a bit when COVID hit, right? Yeah. So COVID changed a lot of things, including schools participation in extracurriculars, one of which is Rockets for Schools. But the climate changed there a little bit, and we have more teams that are not just from the Midwest. So it's been an interesting evolution, and I think those numbers are due to grow a little bit. But I think a lot of schools and, again, local groups like Boy Scouts and 4-H and things like that, they're still actively participating in model rocketry. I think that's still a badge for Boy Scouts. So at the hobby level, the model rocketry level, there's still quite good active participation from, I'd say, the majority of, schools and organizations.
You know, this has been going on now for quite a few years. I'm just wondering if this has led to, kids' involvement in this has actually led to them having careers in that area. Do you know at all, Eric?
I certainly do. So, again, I'm not quite the Homer Hickam October Sky story. I kind of view everything from the sidelines and just keep a hobby as a hobby rather than turning into a job. But I have several rocketry acquaintances that I've gotten to know over the years that are working at BlueX, that are working at SpaceX, that are working at NASA or suppliers too. So 100% absolutely yes. There hasn't been a private aerospace industry rocketry organization, I'll say, that I haven't had the chance to tour simply because I have friends in the industry. So absolutely. A lot of people have turned, it's been kind of the catalyst to, the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, the STEM programs. This has been a great gateway into fields in aeronautics, not just rocketry, definitely.
Yeah, I would think, and the skills, the math skills and everything else that you learn has got to make a difference in the classroom.
Yeah, definitely. It takes a special student, right? This is an extra effort above and beyond, right? So this is something, and not just learning from science and math perspective too, but I've mentored a few teams in the past, and to me it was always perhaps surprising at how unfamiliar they were with some basic tools. Cutting, sanding, gluing, things like that. So working with teams, some of those skills that I thought were more basic were really good skills to learn before they exited, I think, middle or high school. So it's been a good growth experience there, too, even if they don't stick with anything that flies in the sky. Again, just that basic ability to use your hands to create, I thought that was a great thing as well.
Absolutely. And Eric, give us there's some websites. There's probably a couple which we can post up on my Larry Mueller show page. Where do people go?
Definitely. Okay. So you were mentioning the event this weekend. That's rocketsforschools.org. That's a great one, too. If you're looking for just general information, I'd mention those two national organizations. There's National Association of Rocketry, which is NAR.org, just NAR.org, not NRA. That's a different one. And then Tripoli Rocketry Organization, which is just tripoli.org. So it's tripoli.org. Some local vendors, Lock Precision, they're out of Plymouth, Wisconsin. That's LOCPRECISION.com. And then Estes Rockets, again, a lot of people that have ever dabbled in rocketry, you know Estes. That's just EstesRockets.com.
Eric, it has been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much for being with us, and I know this event is going to be great fun over the weekend for you. Thanks, Eric. Eric Kamenberg, Eric is our rocket man here in Wisconsin, for sure. It was great fun talking with him. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a look at running, with a founder of the AF Run Club, and then we'll take a look at Wisconsin golf courses. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.